The bees responsible for one-third of the food we eat are disappearing. Also disappearing is the scientific research into why bees are disappearing. And that leads us to ask, why is USDA discouraging its scientific research into the disappearance of bees?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Folks, everybody knows the bees responsible for one-third of the food we eat are disappearing, and everybody, it seems, has a reason or two as to why. What really? Why are bees disappearing? Dr. Jonathan Lundgren has been researching the disappearing bees for 11 years at the USDA's Agriculture Research Service Lab in Brookings, South Dakota. His peer-reviewed research on neonicotinoid or neonic pesticides and their impact on pollinators has been widely published and has received accolades from his scientific contemporaries. However, USDA is apparently not happy with Dr. Lundgren's work, and according to an official complaint filed by Dr. Lundgren, has been doing what it can as an institution to slow and stall the neonic research. Dr. Lundgren is not the only neonic researcher to be so challenged by the USDA, just the latest one. In July of 2014, Dr. Jeffrey Pettis, who is a formerly USDA's lead bee scientist at the Bee Research Lab in Beltsville, Maryland, was demoted from his position at USDA. And just this past spring, 10 USDA scientists filed a petition for USDA to stop ordering researchers to, and I quote, retract studies, water down findings, remove their name from authorship, and endure long indefinite delays in approving publication of papers that may be controversial. This effort to stifle research into the disappearance of bees leads us to ask you, to what extent do we use neonicotinoid pesticides to grow our food? Are the neonicotinoid pesticides harmless to pollinators, like the manufacturers claim? And of course, why is USDA discouraging its scientific research into the disappearance of bees? Well, folks, we thought we were going to have Dr. Lundgren himself, who is a senior research entomologist from USDA's Agriculture Research Service Lab in Brookings, South Dakota. He said he was going to join us, but did not quite make it in today for some reason. Maybe USDA put him up against the wall. I don't know what happened. And also, we invited USDA to join us today for this conversation as to why they might be discouraging research into disappearing bees. And they, of course, sent us a nice letter suggesting that it was beyond their purview and that the 100,000 employees of USDA are too busy to talk to us today. They have other things going on. So, holy smokes, it's just us, you and I, with a question that is truly a head-scratcher. Why is USDA discouraging its scientific research into the disappearance of bees? Quick thumbnail just from me. Dr. Lundgren is a senior researcher at the USDA's Ag Research Facility in Brookings, South Dakota, which, as I understand it, is responsible for researching ways of growing different crops together most effectively. And Dr. Brookings' specialty, it seems to me, is researching the impact of neonicotinoid pesticides on bees. We all knew the bees are disappearing, and Dr. Brookings' research is indicating the fact that it could very well be the responsibility of neonicotinoid pesticides. Now, and it's not just, of course, Dr. Lundgren's research. It's the research from a very broad spectrum of researchers across the country. And USDA is looking at their findings and revolting, as it were, and doing what it can as an institution to suppress that information. They do that by not granting any travel funds. They do that by suppressing publication of information and by suppressing the collaboration of researchers. So what exactly are the neonics? Well, think of the root word for neonicotinoid pesticide. What is the root word? Of course, is nicotine. And what is nicotine? It's the magic ingredients in tobacco. Forever, what we have done with nicotine is that we soak it in water and then use a solution to spray on plants and kill bugs. Thus, the neonicotinoids. What they are then, as I understand it, are synthesized varieties of nicotine. So they've been synthesized in the laboratory and made much more powerful by companies, I think Syngenta and DuPont, but I'm not sure exactly. But at any rate, sold throughout the United States, it is our most used pesticide. We use more neonics than anything else. How do we use it? We spray it. But we also coat all of the seeds we plant with this neonic pesticide. So essentially, we're drowning our environment in a pesticide designed to kill insects. Now, the manufacturers of this product, the neonics, say you can use it and it won't harm pollinators like bees and butterflies. So the question is then, how do you make something that kills insects but doesn't kill insects, I think, would be the question. But they say they have done that, and therefore we should be free to use these neonics, and these neonics have consequently become a major tool in the production of our food chain. It's how we eat. It's with neonic pesticides to the greatest extent, not counting those who eat organic foods like our producers here, my wife, who don't eat them. So now the government, is looking at the reason our bees are disappearing. Now, to what extent are our bees disappearing? I've seen figures as high as 40% a year. So it's like kind of like custard, the greasy grass almost, for our bees. They're just disappearing. Why? Some say the reason they're disappearing is because of a lack of habitat. You know, when you have like 1,000 acres of one crop, there's not much diversity there. The flowers bloom once and then they're gone. And then there's nothing left for the bees to eat. Thus, the habitat is the problem. Others say it's the tracheal mite, a pest of the predator of the bee that's the problem. Others say it's global warming. But some say, and there are a lot of serious scientists who say, the reason the bees are disappearing is that we're using too much neonicotinoid pesticides. And because we're using too much of it, we're killing the bees, and the bees are simply disappearing. Now, what does that mean to us? Who cares about the bees, right? Why should we care about the bees? Well, we should care about bees because bees are responsible for about one-third of the food we eat through their efforts to pollinate crops. It's all about the birds and the bees, and that's how we live. And without bees, you could scratch off about one-third of the food we eat, which is a lot. So that is a significant consideration, and thus the scientific effort to find the cause for the disappearance. And why are they disappearing? Well, Dr. Jonathan Lundgren and a lot of associates say the reason they're disappearing is because of the neonicotinoid pesticides. The farmers who use those pesticides and rely on them, and the manufacturers who make them and sell them, don't want that to be the case because it's big, big money, right? So thus, the conflict between the bees and the neonics and the science and the USDA and you and I. So the question on the table today for you, because none of our guests have shown up, is why is USDA sitting on the research as to the disappearance of our bees? Why are they going after the researchers like Dr. Lundgren? Why? What do you think? 831-479-1080 is the phone number today. Pick up your phone and join us. Want to hear what you have to say? Because, well, you're the expert. There are no other experts. It's you and I on Food Chain Radio. 831-479-1080. Why is USDA suppressing the research?
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Today, we're talking about the disappearance of the bees in general, but specifically, why is the United States Department of Agriculture stifling its own research into the disappearance of those bees? Yes, they're disappearing. We all know they are, but we don't know why. And there are significant scientific research among them. Dr. Jonathan Lundgren, who's a senior research entomologist at USDA's Agriculture Research Service Lab in Brookings, South Dakota, who have been studying the impact of neonicotinoid pesticides on bees and saying, look what's happening. But USDA is stifling his research to the extent that Dr. Lundgren filed an official complaint. Now, can you imagine working for an institution, a federal institution with 100,000 employees, and raising your hand and saying, you're messing up here, you're stifling the research as to what's going on, why are you doing this? So Dr. Lundgren had agreed to join us today, but he has since not. And I don't know why he hasn't, but he did not. I also asked USDA to join us today to explain why they're stifling research. And they sent a nice page explanation that I would read, but it would take a whole hour to read it and I wouldn't understand it anyway. So they let it be said that they respectfully decline. So it's just you and I left to figure out why USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, is stifling research into the disappearance of bees. What does that mean? I have no idea, but I bet you'll have an idea. So we're going to go to you. We're going to start with David tuning in from San Francisco. David, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hey, how are you, Michael? I would say that it's a couple of different things. One is polluters. Obviously, you know, if the polluters engage the greatest amount of the economy, then they're able to claim that they have to make money and keep the economy going. And so trade secrets are going to stifle the economy. And so they can't release the kind of poisons they're dumping on us. And
now, wait a minute. You got me a little bit confused. I understand the notion of trade secrets. And when you do research, you learn about, you know, the impact of what's in the pesticides and how that impacts on the critters, on the bees especially. Is that what you're talking about, those trade secrets?
It can be. For example, you remember when the Gulf of Mexico was being destroyed by BP, but, you know, a few years ago. And the company, BP, had a cleanser that they were using to break up the oil, and it's called Corexit. And the nation of Great Britain refuses to allow Corexit to be used in the North Sea, but the United States got stuck with it, poured out and abandoned. And when the Obama administration tried to find the formula for Corexit, BP claimed that it was a trade secret.
Trade secret, yeah, and you can't
have
it. Okay.
Now, it's just extrapolated from cleaning up oil spills to the food. That they're claiming that they have a business right to use this product, but we, the people, don't have the right to find out what's in it.
Mm-hmm. But what if the research by Dr. Lundgren and so many other people, oh, my goodness, hold the phone. Let me see here.
Is that him calling in?
Or? Yes.
Okay. Maybe, yeah. I mean, I would guess
okay, just
along
a sec.
Those lines.
Dr.
Yes.
Lundgren, is that you?
Yes.
Boy, thank you for tuning in. I was so happy to have we were worried that the USDA took you out behind the barn or something. So, David, thank you so much for your call.
Could I ask him a separate?
Yes, really quickly.
All right. Well, it, the Pentagon has got a they've known that global warming is happening, and in 2004 they had a study that said they expected food riots by the year 2020. Now, obviously, there have been very little infrastructure development in those last 10 years to prepare the public for local gardening, for local food production, as opposed to all our eggs in one basket hauling corn from Venezuela or someplace. They've allowed still more monopolization of food. And so the Pentagon,
David, focus on the bees for me, please.
Well, be specific. I mean, if the Pentagon is expecting food riots, is this part of a quick kill, like in Carthage, they are intending to kill us, and rather than
thank you, thank you, David. Appreciate it. Well, I don't know how you want to answer that one.
I honestly
don't
have an answer for that one.
Neither do I. Well, start us off really quickly, Dr. Lundgren. You're a senior researcher at USDA Brookings, South Dakota. You've been looking intently at neonicotinoids and their impact on bees and other pollinators. What exactly is the neonic?
Number one, yes, I'm a USDA employee, but I am on this radio show. They really wanted me to stress that I'm not representing the USDA nor any USDA views.
Okay, fair enough. And as I said at the beginning of the show, we did invite USDA to participate, but all 100,000 employees are too busy to talk today.
A neonicotinoid is a seed treatment. It's an insecticide. It's a broad spectrum insecticide that's all neurotoxic to insects.
It's neurotoxic to insects. What does that mean?
Yes. So it affects the nervous system of insects. It excites the nervous system, and so it overstimulates the nerves, and the insects aren't able to function after consuming it. It has to be ingested by the insect in order for it to have an effect.
Mm-hmm. And how is it applied?
The primary way that neonics are applied is on insecticidals as a seed treatment. And so a lot of your corn, soybeans, wheat, alfalfa, sunflowers, canola, you name it. Most of these crop seeds these days are treated with various pesticides, and then the neonicotinoid is no different. And it is then it's taken up by the plant systemically. And what
Whoa.
That means that it's is that developing seedling has this neonicotinoid insecticide that is produced from the roots all the way up to the pollen and the nectar.
So then the plant itself becomes an insecticide.
That's right. And so it's a prophylactic approach to pest management. It's an insurance policy. At least that's how it's marketed.
Mm-hmm. And the manufacturers of the neonics say that they do not harm pollinators like bees and butterflies and whatnot.
Right. That is the statement that's often given. But it's a broad spectrum insecticide, and there's costs and benefits to every decision that we do, right? And so seeing that there's not going to be any consequences to the use of insecticides is not giving the whole picture. It's not giving the whole picture.
So how is it that a company can manufacture a pesticide that kills insects but doesn't kill insects?
You would have to ask them, and I'm sure they would be able to give you an answer for that question. But
well, they must have. They must have. Do they not do some kind of research? I mean,
pardon me.
Do they not do some?
They do have to do research, and they. I think that they actually they have to provide data to the regulatory agencies that demonstrate in some way that these pesticides are safe for the environment, or they do not pose unreasonable risk. And that unreasonable risk is defined by the regulatory agency.
Okay. When we come back, I want to ask about your research, because evidently your research is being stifled by USDA. At least that's what you claim in the official complaint. Not just your research, but it seems like a whole bunch of researchers looking into the impact of neonics and bees and other pollinators is being suppressed. And so we're going to ask why as we go down the line. But I want to ask about Dr. Jonathan Lundgren's research and what it has told him about the impact of neonics and bees. Then we'll go to the phones, 831-479-1080. Right back. Okay, folks, you know it and I know it, and everybody in the world knows the bees are disappearing, and everybody, it seems, has an idea as to why. One idea that is being looked at intently by a number of researchers, including Dr. Jonathan Lundgren, who is a senior researcher up at the USDA's Brookings Research Lab in Brookings, South Dakota, is that the neonicotinoid pesticides are having an adverse impact on our bees. Dr. Lundgren, how many bees are disappearing?
Well, this is a major crisis right now. The beekeepers, in informal surveys, just discussions with some of the beekeepers, they're losing between 50% and 90% of their hives this year.
50% and 90%? That is like custard to greasy grass. That's a massacre.
This is a serious issue, and it's not just the bees. I mean, if we look at many of the different organisms that we live with, between, you know, terrestrial vertebrates, things with backbones, we're looking at farmland birds and songbirds that are insectivorous. We're looking at wetlands now. We're looking at bats, butterflies. This is a biodiversity crisis that we're facing right now.
So we're all at, like, custard to greasy grass.
We are all connected to that biodiversity. We need that biodiversity. We need these other animals and insects in our lives, whether we like them or not.
Well, Dr. Lundgren, you've been looking at the impact of neonics and bees for a number of years. What have you seen?
Well, we've seen that pesticides and the broad use of these things as a prophylactic method, as an insurance policy in agriculture, is becoming more and more prevalent. 13% of the terrestrial land surface of our country is treated with neonicotinoid seed treatments.
Wait a minute. Say that one more time.
13%, by my estimates, 13% of the terrestrial land surface of the continental United States is treated with neonicotinoids. And they're not improving farm productivity, and so the farmers are paying for them. Sometimes they don't even know that they're using them, but they're paying for them $10 to $15 an acre, and they're not thinking about the consequences of these things.
So 13% of the landmass of the United States is covered with neonicotinoid pesticides at the rate of $10 to $15 an acre. That's a lot of money.
Yes, that's on an annual basis.
Wow. So what has been the impact of your research on the body politic?
Well, I guess we wrote a paper. I mean, we questioned neonicotinoids and we questioned RNAi, which is a new form of genetic pesticide that your listeners should probably educate themselves about if they haven't heard of this already.
Heard about it last week for the first time, so I think we'll be featuring it on the food chain here pretty quick.
I think it's worth at least, whether you love it or hate it, everybody should know what's coming down the pike.
Yeah.
We found that neonicotinoids, we were interested in the monarch diophs specifically. A lot of that is due to habitat reduction.
Mm-hmm.
But we were seeing milkweed plants, which is the sole source of food for monarchs. We were seeing an awful lot of these out there still, but the monarchs still weren't being found. I mean, we were looking on these milkweed plants and we weren't seeing monarchs. And so we started to test them, and 60% of those milkweed plants were contaminated with neonicotinoids, even though they had never been treated before.
How did that happen? How did because it's a systemic pesticide, how did the milkweed plants become systematized, as it were?
Right. What a great question. So what it illustrates is that the neonicotinoids, only 2 to 20% of the active ingredient is taken up by the crop plant itself. And it really begs the question of where the other 80 to 98% of these toxins are going in the environment. And what we're finding as the scientific community, the public sector scientific community, is they're finding it in the waterways, and they're finding it in plants that have never been treated before. And things like milkweed plants are starting to take these things up because they are so systemic, and they can be fairly persistent in the environment. And so this pathway, I don't think we entirely understand how it's getting out into the environment, but nevertheless, I think that we really need to be cognizant of when you're putting this much pesticide out there. And it is a very toxic pesticide to insects. It's some work out of Europe showed that it was 5,000 to 7,000 times more toxic to bees than DDT was.
So what did USDA react to your research?
Well, when we proposed to submit the manuscript, we have as many aspects of our jobs as federal scientists, we have to have approval. And they gave approval.
Well, wait a minute. Who gives you approval?
Line management.
Okay.
Management does. So they said, okay, you can submit this for publication, and then it got press. The study got a lot of press. In fact, it's one of the top five, it's in the top 2% of all articles ever published in terms of social media impact. And so USDA line management came back and said, oh, on second thought, you don't have approval to submit that paper, and because you did submit it without approval, you are now going to be punished. And so they sent a very clear message that these research results were not okay.
You're not the only one.
No, I think that more and more scientists have come forward. We filed they suspended me for 2 weeks without pay. And so we filed a whistleblower retaliation complaint as a result of that study, amongst other things, because there's been an increasing level of aggression over the last 2 years. And as that whistleblower retaliation complaint went to the court system for federal employees, we got more and more wind of other employees that have been facing the same thing. This has been going on for a long time. And stifling of federal scientists and the research that they're doing and muzzling them if the results are inconvenient or politically threatening, that's not okay. I mean, that's a violation of basic human rights in the United States of America. And yeah,
Well, okay, so this, Dr. Lundgren, takes us to the fundamental question of the day, which is, why is USDA discouraging its scientific research? It's scientific research. You belong to them. You are their property. You are their research. Why are they suppressing their research into the disappearance of our bees? There are bees. Whose bees are they?
Right. Well, you're right. Taxpayers are funding the research that we are doing, and it's been my philosophy that if the taxpayers are funding it, then I need to be communicating what we're finding as the scientific results that we're finding.
Okay, we're going to go to the phones when we get back. Do stay tuned and pick up your phone, 831-479-1080. Well, ladies and gentlemen, get these numbers. 13% of the land mass of the United States of America, 13% is covered in neonicotinoid pesticides. Now, God, I sent producer Dylan Hunsinger in search of information. Dylan, how many acres of land are in the United States?
Well, I was just doing some quick research and math here, and it looks like there's 2.3 billion acres
and
of 13%
land. Of that
U.S. And 13% of that would come out to 300 million acres or 299 million.
Okay, 300 million acres times $15 an acre.
And so we're looking at just shy of $4.5 billion.
Okay, there it is, folks. $4.5 billion worth of neonicotinoid pesticides are applied to the United States every year. Every single year. What impact are they having on the United States? Well, Dr. Jonathan Lundgren, who is a senior research entomologist at USDA's Agriculture Research Service in Brookings, South Dakota, saying it's having a big impact throughout the food chain, not just with pollinators like monarch butterflies and bees, but through birds and everything. It's there. So we're going to go to the phone right now. And the question of the day is, why is USDA trying to get rid of all of this research? And we're going to start with Jeff. Jeff, welcome to the food chain. You are a beekeeper?
Yeah, I'm a commercial beekeeper in SoCal.
Uh-huh.
So I heard you start the show and you didn't have your doctor there. And I was like, uh-oh. So I decided I'd call in and just let you know what we're seeing out in the field. So
tell us what we're seeing in the field.
In the field, we are seeing that we made up to 1,100 new hives. We're up to 1,100 total in summertime. Right now, we are down below 500. So
wow.
Yeah, there's, you know, over 60% loss. And, you know, just by looking in the hives and stuff, we can't really tell what's going on. You know, there's no for sure, you know, oh, this is what killed it. So 25 years ago, before the row mites even came, we would look at about a 10 to 15% loss. So that just kind of shows you where we're at now.
Well, that's a good point right there. Dr. Lundgren, have you looked at the timing of this, at the timing of our use of synthetic neonics and the beginning of the collapse of bees? I mean, is there a time frame there?
Yeah, there's a fairly strong correlation between the proliferation of neonicotinoid use and colony collapse disorder. And that doesn't necessarily mean that neonicotinoids are causing it. That is a correlation, though. And I think that it really gets back to a bigger question. And that is that what we're experiencing, in my view, my personal view, is a simplification of our food production systems. Our cropland has become so simplified, and really the only way to maintain those simplified, you know, systems, you know, monocultures of individual plants, is with agrochemicals and pesticides. And so neonicotinoids are really part and parcel of a deeper problem. So as we're limiting the food available to bees, we're also poisoning or disseminating more insecticide into the environment alongside that.
And so two things. We're limiting the amount and kinds of food they eat, it would be like us just living on cheeseburgers for the rest of our lives.
Exactly. And then, so, I mean, there's a lot of stressors that are going on, but we're not going to solve the bee problem simply by eliminating neonicotinoids. It's got to be a more systemic shift. And that's why we're focusing on that with Blue Dasher Farm Initiative, is trying to answer the questions and the research questions that farmers and beekeepers need that we're not able to do within the federal system. So I would encourage you guys, if you're interested, to go to www.bluedasher.farm in order to find out a little bit more about it.
How do you spell that?
www.bluedasher.
Blue Dasher.
Yep. It's a dragonfly species.
Okay, bluedasher.farm. All right, let's go to Rory. Rory, welcome to the food chain.
Yeah.
Fire away.
Yes, Michael. Hey, good show. I just want to ask a couple questions. Number one,
sure.
You guys did that back of the envelope measurement on how much neonic is being used across the U.S. You can't take the entire land mass of the continental U.S. because only so much of that is arable. So 300 million acres times $15 to the acre is that's not a good number. I'm sure the Kemi guys would love that if that was the case. But at any rate, I just want to say that I know there's other things working against honeybees here as far as like varroamite.
Varroamites, loss of habitat is a big one.
Foul brood, et cetera, et cetera. So there are other things. And I wanted to ask the doctor, if he's aware, I've heard that even with the use of neonics in Australia, you know, starting with imidacloprid and some of the others, they don't have colony collapse disorder operative in Australia.
Oh, interesting.
And if that's the case, if it's just the neonics and they're using the same chemistries, why aren't they seeing it down there in the continent of Australia?
Well, that's a great point. And they are actually seeing bee die-offs this current year. But you're right in that neonics aren't the only issue, okay? We need to realize that there's a deeper problem here, and that neonics are a symptom of that deeper problem. So the neonicotinoids are certainly a stressor. We know that they have an adverse effect on honeybees. But they're not the only thing that's out there. And it may be a synergistic effect. You know what I mean? What if you've got varroa mites, which is a pest that sucks the blood of bees?
Varroa mites feeding on neonics? Oh, my God. Right back. Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Welcome back, folks. Michael Olson, Food Chain Radio Program. I'm going to go quickly back to Rory. Rory, are you there?
Yeah. I know that the chemical company. Now, I'll let your guest know. I work as a consultant in strawberries in production, both conventional and organic. I'm not tied to the chemical companies. I use some of their products for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I avoid the neonics in my program.
Just why? Why do you avoid neonics?
Well, because the way we farm the berries, we're able to avoid them. They're kind of a tool of last resort. If some of the other softer chemistries or other methods don't, you know, fail us, and there's lots of reasons why that could happen.
And it seems like we might
reach for them, but they're a little harsh on some of the beneficial insect populations. We're using vacuums, we're using softer chemistries to build up our beneficials. But the thing is, they aren't as bad as as effective as they are. They're nowhere near as persistent in the environment. From my observation, that's just, you know, the day in and week out observations of some of the older chemistries. I know they're more potent because you use less per acre. But anyway, I know that some of the, like Bayer, for example, they set up a whole, I think it was Bayer, set up a whole bee research center out there on the, in the Carolinas, if I'm not mistaken. And I'd be interested to know what your guess, where's the research regarding the off-target movement of the neonics? Is it imidacloprid, which is produced by, I think Bayer produces that, doesn't it? Anyway, the off-target movement is a concern.
What the heck does that mean?
Know, and the lack of bio. Well, if you apply it here on seed, and if you're putting it as a seed coat, you're not using that much material per acre. So they're not coating entire acres. There's a little coating on each seed.
Sure.
So there's some active ingredient per acre, but it's measurable. But for that to move off the seed coat, over to affect monarchs on, you know, milkweed, you know.
Well, that's what he was talking about, exactly.
How is that happening? Is there more research done on that? Do the chemical companies, are they doing any research on the off-target movement?
Yeah, how does this stuff get around, Dr. Lundgren?
Well, it's highly water-soluble, and so we think that it's getting into the water. We know that it's showing up in wetlands, and it's starting to disrupt food chains within aquatic systems now. And that's been done in our region specifically. And so I have a feeling that that's how it's going to affect things. There's also planter dust, but there's ways that we can reduce planter dust in order to mitigate that particular pathway. But I have a feeling that once it's in the soil, that's going to be an issue. And depending, your caller is absolutely right. I mean, this is, in some ways, this is a much lower environmental exposure, but you have to also look at the relative toxicity. And the persistence of the compounds really depends on the context, so it depends on what soils are involved and what other circumstances are out there. But it has been documented that these can persist for at least a few years within the soil matrix. So,
wow. Okay, let's go quickly to Diana. Diana, welcome to the food chain.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great program. I remember when DDT was such a fight. I'm an old environmental student. Science student from way back, and we didn't have to fight the government like this.
Really,
and
quickly, honey, we're just about out of time.
Okay, yeah, we weren't fighting the government like this. We just had, there's an inclination, the eggs are thinning, we're showing a lot of bird loss, and the government got on it.
And there it is, and today the government is stifling the research. Why, doctor?
Why? I think there's a lot of fear. I think there's a lot of fear out there right now.
And we'll have to let it go at that. Folks, as this has been the Food Chain Radio Program, Dr. Jonathan Lundgren, thank you so much for joining us. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is a foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.